Thank you for joining us for another Hagley History Hangout. My name is Gregory Hargreaves, Assistant Director of the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington, Delaware. Now, you know, during these history hangouts, we like to bring you some of the great work being done by scholars who have received support in the form of research grants and fellowships of different kinds from the Hagley Center. One such scholar joins me today. Chris Morris is Professor of History at the University of Texas at Arlington. Chris, thanks for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's start by painting with broad strokes, so to speak. What is it that
Okay.
you're researching and writing about at the moment?
Commodification of nitrogen. So this substance that is all around us, 78.8% of the atmosphere, all living creatures, plants and animals need it. But with the exception of a few types of bacteria, no living organisms can access it. And so for most of life on the history of life on Earth, plants and animals have relied on these bacteria to take it out of the atmosphere, and the term is fix it, usually turning it into ammonia that plants can access. And then animals eat plants, and animals that eat plants, and it moves up the food chain. But what happened beginning mostly in the 19th century was people, farmers, sharp businessmen, increasingly chemists, figured out how to find sources of fixed nitrogen and trade it around the world, primarily to farmers. It was also used forms of nitrogen compounds were important for munitions, nitrates and gunpowder, for example. And that's where the DuPonts and the Hagley Museum comes in. And then early in the 20th century, chemists and industrialists figured out how to bypass the organic sources of fixed nitrogen, the work done by bacteria, and fix it themselves industrially. And so that's my project, really. How did because it's this thing that's all around us. Think of the ocean. And you're thirsty, and there's that water all around you, and you can't get access to the drinkable water because of the salt that's in it, and you depend on normal processes of transpiration. You want the ocean to evaporate, and then you capture the rainwater that or the condensation of the ocean that leaves the salt out, and that's sort of what happened. And it's this long process of figuring out how to get a hold of nitrogen in such a way that you can package it, ship it, sell it, buy it, apply it anywhere in the world. And it's a history that's never been told completely. There have been histories of guano and histories of nitrates and histories of various at the industrial synthetically fixed nitrogen, the Haber-Bosch process that as it's known, but the whole story of capturing nitrogen in such a way that it can be commodified is what I'm working on.
What a fascinating project. And it seems to me that the theme is that you have this incredibly abundant resource, but it needs to be mediated in order to make it accessible and valuable, especially in an economic context.
Exactly. Yes. In an economic context, and that economic context becomes global, but it's also scientific, figuring out how to do it, and it's also very much social. It involves because it was so important to life and to agriculture in particular, but also to munitions, so life and death, we might say, then it had social dimensions to it as well. So my particular story is told from the perspective of an Alabama sharecropper in the early 20th century who needed to put nitrogen in his soil. His cotton plants needed it. There was no negotiating with the soil and the plants. Those were, you know, fixed laws of nature, we might say. So that gave the fertilizer dealers, the guano, as he called them, guano dealers, even though it wasn't, we're not talking bird guano here, it was just a synonym for fertilizer. But the dealers had leverage over him. And on several occasions, when they thought they could drive him into bankruptcy and grab his land and his mules and his plows and everything on the cheap through a bankruptcy auction, they just stopped selling him the nitrogen fertilizer. And so he had to figure out how to deal with that on several occasions. Ultimately, he ended up in a shootout and went to prison. But this happens elsewhere in this history, this sort of social, like interpersonal, political conflict. At this time, there were lots of mom and pop fertilizer dealers that were at risk of being taken over by larger corporations that were forming. The larger corporations were competing with other large corporations. The American corporations were competing with the German corporations. And then there was competition between the countries, you know, the United States and Germany and Great Britain. And then when there were periods of wars, during the First World War in particular, the whole nitrogen for fertilizer business gets hijacked by nitrogen for munitions business. Mm-hmm. And so all of this contest and conflict is wrapped up in this very fascinating history.
Yeah, it seems like a very rich subject.
It is. It's vast. It's a global history. I call it, my subtitle is, which I'm still working on, but it's along the lines of the global history of an Alabama cotton patch. So that's how I'm keeping hold, you know, containing this history that could very easily get out of control. I keep asking myself, what does this have to do with Ned Cobb in Alabama? And then I know I'm still on track.
I love that approach, especially the way it makes explicit those connections between the local and the global.
Right.
In a very elegant way. That's great.
Oh, thank you.
Could you perhaps unpack a little bit more for us the transition from organic sources of nitrogen to synthetic?
Sure. In fact, I've been writing a little bit about that recently. The transition begins to occur at the end of the 19th century. Most of the organically produced nitrogen is coming from, in the middle of this century anyway, it's coming from Peruvian or Peruvian guano and bird guano. But nitrogen is also coming from other sources produced in the United States. In slaughterhouses, for example, the stockyards in Chicago and elsewhere get involved in selling blood and bones to fertilizer dealers who they process it. They grind the bones and they dry the blood and they produce a powder and it has a certain amount of nitrogen in it. And they mix that with sometimes fish scrap. So there's an industry for catching fish, small fish. They're kind of like anchovies, and they live in the estuaries of the Chesapeake Bay and the coast of North Carolina. And they're caught, and they're kind of processed and ground up. And there's a certain amount of nitrogen in them as well. All this stuff gets mixed together. And eventually, around the 1870s or so, the Chileans, or not the Chileans, the Peruvians are concerned that all their guano was going elsewhere in the world. And so they put a halt on the trade. And fertilizer dealers and merchants have to go elsewhere. Then they find mineralized nitrates in the Atacama Desert of Chile. And that becomes an important source of nitrogen in fertilizer as well. But there's really not enough that can be gathered, extracted from sources around the world. And in particular, the trade itself puts certain countries at a strategic disadvantage. Germany, for example, realizes that if it's going to get nitrogen for its soil, it's got to trade with Peru and Chile and other places. And that puts it at the mercy of the British Royal Navy. And of course, we know, what they were seeing or imagining was exactly what happened in the First World War when the Royal Navy blockaded Germany. So Germany and a few other countries in Europe and Scandinavia begin to develop alternative ways of capturing and fixing atmospheric nitrogen. The problem with that, the real block in that process, was that atmospheric nitrogen actually consists of two nitrogen atoms in a very strong triple bond that needs to be broken if you're going to make other compounds with the nitrogen, like ammonia. And that's what a few species of cyanobacteria are able to do, but the rest of us can't. And for people to do it industrially, they need a tremendous source of energy. So the chemists tried to figure out first how to do it if you have access to energy. And in Norway, for example, because it had at the end of the 19th century an abundance of hydroelectric power, was able to develop a process for fixing nitrogen, but it used a tremendous source amount of energy. The Germans didn't have that energy, and they ultimately came up with a lower energy, still took a fair amount, but not as much to produce ammonia. And this was the so-called Haber-Bosch process. But the Germans were encouraged to do this because they didn't have access to the high seas and to, global trade, and that the United States had, and that the British had. And then they kept it a secret as they're working on this. But at the same time, in the 1890s, there was this growing concern about food production, that there was going to be a global shortage. The population was reaching the limit of, global agricultural output. And there was a gathering of chemists, a British Society of Chemists in, I believe, Bristol in the 1890s, 1896, somewhere around in there. And the keynote speaker charged chemists with solving the problem, So this problem, it's all about soil chemistry, and the chemists of this society can solve this problem. And within a few years, they essentially had. But it wasn't British chemists; it was German chemists that solved it. So that's, I mean, so it's both geopolitical and it's also scientific, kind of merging at the at that time. The effect of synthetically fixed nitrogen doesn't really have its biggest impact until well into the 20th century, because the First World War intervenes. The Germans keep their methods secret. There's a lot of industrial espionage that goes on. And then there's the Depression. And there seem to be alternative sources. American companies and the US government tries to adapt the Norwegian methods to make cyanamide. And so factories open up at Niagara Falls, where there's hydroelectricity. There's a plan to open a factory in northern Alabama at Muscle Shoals, where they can produce hydroelectric energy. But eventually, the Haber-Bosch process makes its way into the US. During peace times, the German producers, BASF is the major German producer, wants access to the American market. American companies want access to the technology, and they work out, but they don't want the Germans actually selling in the American market, and they work out arrangements. And the DuPont company plays a leading role in this, sometimes in the open and sometimes in secret, out of sight of government regulators, antitrust regulators, and people, officials concerned about American technology and national security and so forth. So that becomes an interesting dimension in this story.
Now, I suspect it was DuPont that brought you to the Hagley.
Yes, it was. And of course this the science and technology in general. I came to the Hagley not knowing exactly what all I would find. And I was interested in rec hoping to find records for some of the companies that were fixing nitrogen that the DuPont company bought up. And I was hoping that maybe those records exist in the Hagley archives. And a lot of them did. And they were very helpful in figuring out just some of the personalities, the chemists and the businessmen, and the different technologies that they were working on. But what I found was more information on the global business and political side of this history than I was aware of. And I was surprised to find how central DuPont was in that history. That they were, because they're primarily a munitions manufacturing company, at least at that time. And I was more interested in fertilizer. What I learned while I'm working at the Hagley was the relationship between the two, and that DuPont and other businessmen were very aware of the relationship and operated accordingly. So if DuPont was, it did open factories that made fertilizer, but if it opened factories that made ammonia to produce nitrates for munitions, it also sold ammonia to other companies for fertilizer. It had the knowledge so that it could operate munitions factories that the government opened up, the War Department, as it was called at the time, opened up to make weapons. This was during the Second World War, to make munitions, and then to continue to operate these government factories during peacetime for a couple of years until the factories were transitioned to civilian use, primarily for fertilizer, at which point DuPont either withdrew, and it did in many cases, and other companies took over the facilities, or it held on to them. But what I mostly learned about was DuPont's efforts to work with the Germans to get the technology, maintain control over the American market, and essentially carve up the world into spheres of influence. The Germans created a cartel, really, in Europe. The American companies didn't officially join the cartel, but negotiated with them. And what was at stake was access to places like China, as well as South America, to sell nitrogen fertilizer, ammonia. And a lot of this was done secretly. And beginning in the early 1930s, actually, it goes back into the 20s in the case of DuPont. And it continues even into the war. After the war had started, DuPont and IG Farben, which is the huge conglomerate that includes BASF at this time in Germany, are colluding to control the technology and production of ammonia that will be used in weapons even during the war. So even when DuPont is given federal government contracts, War Department contracts to produce munitions for the United States, they're still working with the Germans to try to figure out, the technology, and to control the markets. So this is really what I was learning. I wasn't aware of the scope of all of this. And then there's the during the war period and afterwards. What I found in the Hagley archives was some of the memos and the drafts of legal briefs and so forth produced by company lawyers in response to lawsuits brought against the company after the war for some of its antitrust activities. And cases, certainly some of the cases were prominent in the court records. The Supreme Court and some of the appeals court records are readily available online, but the thinking inside the company is not. And that was pretty interesting. And just the memos between some of the executives, the way they reacted. I can imagine them getting word that there's yet another antitrust suit, and read the memo, and from the tone of the memo, I can imagine the man having a temper tantrum in his office, like, "Oh, I can't believe another one, Don't they understand this isn't antitrust activity? This is just business." So that's especially helpful to me because it puts life, it puts flesh and blood on this history.
Speaking of, I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to your methodology in conducting archival research on environmental subjects, that is to say, especially doing environmental history in business archives. Could you maybe speak to that a little bit?
There's not really anything different about the method. I do what any historian does, and I sit down in the archives and I go through these folders of records, and I make notes, and sometimes I take pictures of them if I need a copy of them, because some of them are just so rich with information, and I want to be able to reread it at a later point. What makes environmental history research different is it's just what I'm attuned to. Anytime there is mention of a resource, a place, a process that involves interaction between people and the natural world, then it's like my antenna start, twitching. And so if they're talking about producing ammonia in a factory, I want to know, well, what are the raw materials and what are the locations that they're coming from? Where does the waste go? What's the impact on the local environment of producing ammonia? So a lot of the factories were opened in coal mining and iron ore refining factories, where the coal was burned because you could get some of the byproducts of burning coal were then used to fix nitrogen synthetically. So Virginia and West Virginia became important locations, but waste was dumped into the river and into the air. And those are the things that I think about. And in addition to the effect of nitrogen fertilizer itself in the soil, what are the environmental effects of this expansion of agriculture, this intensification of working the soil by supplementing it with nitrogen? It doesn't all go into the plants. A certain amount of it runs off into the oceans. We're familiar with the phenomenon these days of hypoxia, when agricultural runoff feeds algae in the oceans. And the algae blooms and then dies, and the bacteria feeding on the dead algae sucks all the oxygen out of the water, and the fish die. So all of these sorts of connections I begin to think about when I'm just looking at documents, in a business library or any other library.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It's just been really great.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I can talk about this all day long, in case, maybe every day, if in case it doesn't appear that way. I really can talk and talk about this. It's a fascinating subject.
It really is. And thank you very much. And for the audience, if you would like more Hagley History Hangouts, more information on the Center for the History of Business, Technology, and Society at the Hagley Museum and Library, you can join us online. Visit hagley.org. That's HAGLEY.ORG. Don't be a stranger.